This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend of mine.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
All right, here it is, another Brock and Salk podcast. Hello, buddy.
Hello, Michael.
How are you?
I hate to do this to you.
Do what?
Early in the show.
Oh, right off the bat?
Do you remember what you said to end our last podcast?
No.
It was skate.
What did I say? You could tell me anything right now and I would believe you. I'm getting up at 4:15 in the morning.
Oh, so good.
I don't remember anything. This all happens pre-nap. I don't remember anything I say in the show every day. I don't like.
That's
I haven't
dangerous. Man.
I've barely talked and seen my kids.
How's your eye twitch doing? I haven't noticed.
The eye twitch seems like it's gotten better.
Yeah, hydrate, man.
Dude, I am. I'm drinking green smoothies. I'm hydrating. I'm keeping the weight off.
Are you
I don't remember
doing smoothies?
Anything. Yes.
Are you eating any food? Or
no,
is
I'm eating.
He's eating
food
a daily apple.
No, I'm eating
fragrant apple.
In the mornings, I'm going smoothies until after lunch, and then I'm eating a normal dinner.
Oh, good.
But
okay.
I've been able to keep the weight off. I'm very pro green smoothie.
Love it.
I figured out the best combination of fruit for the smoothie is banana, blueberry, peach, pineapple. Banana, blueberry, peach, pineapple with some spinach and some kale.
Meanwhile,
that's how we go.
I have a 20-pound brisket.
Oh, that sounds
good. That's thawing in my fridge right now.
That sounds really good.
Up on Thursday.
Interesting.
Oh, very nice.
So, what did I say to you?
You said you ended last week's podcast saying, "Hey, next week's podcast will be unlike maybe any we've ever done." The Mariners are in a playoff hunt. The Kraken are in exhibition. The Seahawks are in San Francisco. I mean, it's going to be a huge, epic, one of the biggest sports weekends in Seattle sports history.
It was. It was one of the biggest, don't you think?
I do.
I mean, unfortunately, the Mariners fell short and lost 2 out of 3, but...
I had 140,000 fans packed the place.
And it felt different from all of those others. The Kraken did, they played, and they're going to get going next Tuesday. I can't wait. I've watched almost every one of their preseason games. I'm all in on that. I really actually like how they look.
Have you thought about vlogging it?
No, I have not. Do you want me to vlog it?
I don't know what that means. What is vlog?
That's video blogging.
Video blogging.
Yeah.
I think you should.
I don't know.
You should vlog it.
Think about how much
vlog.
My eye would be twitching if I had to do that.
Constant twitch.
Essentially, yeah. It'd be like just one gross twitch.
Following the puck. How quick can Mike's eyes move?
Yeah, exactly. Nobody wants to see my eye twitch vlogging. And the Seahawks took care of business, which, by the way, I was sort of confident in that. I felt pretty good about the Seahawks winning that game. I said it last week. I was like, don't panic. We've seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can look at the Seahawks and say, essentially, they're 2-2, and they played, obviously, a bad game against Minnesota, and, they're one drive away from being 3-1.
Yep.
I know there's a lot of that's not perfect. They don't look dominant. They don't look like the 2014 or 13 team or anything like that.
Or first half of the first game Seahawks.
Right, but, they should be 3-1 right now, and if they were... You'd be like, yeah, all right. One good Russell drive.
Do your eyes twitch when you watch the Seahawks?
Maybe this Thursday in the Action Green.
Yeah.
That could be a problem.
I like the Action Green. Plus, I'm going.
So you love Action Green. You hate Northwest Green.
Yes.
What's wrong with you?
Goodness
gracious.
I like that Action Green gets brought out once a year. It's special. It's holy. You use it once,
it's
and then
holy.
You move on. Yeah. They're
4-0. It's horrible on
you
the big guys.
That. You don't know that. You
the
can't big, even see
I do
it.
Know that
you
the fat looks
it.
Worse in the Action Green.
Looks fine.
Just like they do in white.
It's not like
big
Cougs,
boys don't like that.
The Cougs have the great gray, but then they start sweating in it, and you're like, oh that just looks really
sweaty. The anthracite,
sweaty.
It starts turning out.
Anthracite? Is that their gray?
It turns into a charcoal.
Well,
it turns into a patina.
But the Mariners, unfortunately, Brock, did not take care of their end of the bargain. That really was the thing that would have been the kicker. The Mariners could have swept. If they had swept, it would have been enough to at least force a game 163. I mean, the Red Sox went and swept in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
The Yankees lost 2-3. The final game didn't matter. But if you had won those two, and they played a little sloppy. They were not as clean as they had been leading up to it. Dylan Moore, I won't say he should have had that ball in left field on Friday night. I will say he could have had that ball, and if he does, maybe they win. Or I did walk down this sliding doors rabbit hole. They ended up walking Ohtani on the next bat because there's the first base open. What if there's men on first and second instead? Do they not walk Ohtani? Does he hit a 3-run home run at that point? And so I'll try not to get too hard on Dylan Moore, the sliding doors thing, just because I think it could have gone a little bit differently. But yeah, they could have done better in the series. And yeah. That's not exactly like the real Angels. Trout's out. Adele is out. The third baseman, Rendon, is out. Upton is out. I mean, four of their best players aren't even playing, and you're getting whacked around by some guy named Marsh. So, like, you know, they did not hold up their end of the bargain.
And Joe Maddon managing like it was game seven of the World
Series.
Joe
Maddon had
particularly Sunday.
A series.
Hold on a minute. You cannot give him grief for that, though. He didn't play Shohei Ohtani. So say what you want. Yes, he's trying to give it his best after not pitching Shohei Ohtani in the game.
He didn't pitch him, but moved him up to leadoff for that final game.
All right, well, good for him. I think he did that the right way. I would support Joe in that.
I got no qualms with Joe Maddon managing that game to teach
those
guys this matters because their draft position doesn't matter
anyways. And also, I'm not just going to give you the game. I'm going to not pitch Shohei Ohtani because that I don't want to risk my guy. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to go hard at trying to make you earn it.
Couldn't you give him the game if it came at the expense of the Yankees or Red Sox?
No. Stop.
Like, lesser of two evils here.
That's a good point. You know what? Yes. That's fair. But I thought I'm not going to give any grief
absolutely
to Joe Maddon
for that.
Absolutely
not. Play
it
if you're
hard,
Joe Maddon, you're in the division. I'm not going to want these guys to gain more confidence. I don't want Kelenic and Logan Gilbert
you've
to have that
experience.
You've got to
tell Ohtani that this thing matters and you're going to make thing work moving
forward. Please stay here.
I didn't even, honestly, that didn't even dawn on me that Maddon wasn't doing anything normal. I thought he was just managing a solid game and trying to beat the Mariners and good on him. Unfortunately,
on Friday, man, their pitching staff knew exactly what to do to get the Mariners off. They threw so many first pitch curveballs in that Friday game. It was unreal.
It's a great atmosphere, though, man. I was there Friday night, and just the...
Was that the best you've ever felt? You've been there for season openers that are packed, and those are different, and other momentous times. Maybe.
Yeah, it was good a few years ago, that 2016 game, the Nelly Cruz game. I was there for that. That was a really good atmosphere that night, too. What I liked about this, and somebody said that it also happened the day of the Supreme Court. Maybe it did. I don't remember that as well. But it just, right from the first inning, it was a baseball crowd.
Yes.
Right? Howdy, you were there Friday night?
Both things were there, Friday and Saturday.
Okay. So Friday night, it was a baseball crowd. First inning, two outs, two strikes on the batter. And by the way, Gonzalez came out. Marco looked great in the first inning. I thought he was going to go like eight shutout innings based on how he threw in the first. And two strikes, two outs, whole crowd started to rise to their feet. And I was like, oh, okay. We're going to treat this like a real baseball game right in the first inning. I was super into it. I thought that was awesome. It was not just people staring blindly at a Jumbotron. People were invested in the game for all nine innings. It kind of went through a lull when the Mariners went through a lull in the middle innings. But when they got the leadoff triple or in the end when Kyle hit the double and led off, it was a real baseball crowd. It was great.
Saturday was unreal.
I bet.
You know, this season, more than any I can remember for like 15 years, there were five different players who had their own chance that the fans started.
Good.
Nothing that the Mariners did at all.
Seawald was definitely the best thing I heard.
Kyle Seager.
Yeah, it was really good.
It was special.
I was at Vista Prime, the steakhouse at Snoqualmie Casino on Saturday with Justin Amora. And I love that, too. I wish I could have been there because I am a little jealous that you got to see the walk-off and all of that. But I was talking about this on the show this week. Baseball can follow you, unlike football, right? Football is your event. You've got your spot. You watch it there. Baseball kind of goes to wherever you are. And I love we were at the bar watching, and like the cheering of random people watching that game when Haniger came up with the hit, that also makes it. That's part of what makes baseball great is it can be in a lot of different places at once. So that was a really, really solid weekend for the Mariners.
So if Dave Sims gave a little like fist pound,
sure,
the first time out, what do you call what he did Saturday night? A little like jab, uppercut.
Yeah, he was pretty into it.
Oh my god!
I mean, and Rick, by the way, I don't know if you've seen the Rick Rubin video.
I saw all of them.
I mean, literally keeping score while giving the call of what was going on. Talk about multitasking! Super impressive.
Yes.
So, what is your big takeaway then? Because this is it. They're done. What do you take out of the season?
Man, it's probably the term that I have heard more. You heard it a lot last year because of the pandemic, and it was a crazy year, and everybody had to adapt, right? You just kind of have to adapt. You have to grind. You have to persevere through it. The word that I have heard this season on the college football road, more than maybe I can ever remember, and I think it's probably the biggest takeaway for this Mariners team, and it's not earth-shattering, but again, it just echoes so much of what I'm already hearing in my other sport, and that is, man, this is a resilient culture. This is a resilient crew. They played how many different people this year? As much as anybody in baseball, right? As far as the number of different personnel that came through that door again. And yet, unlike previous years, Mike, and I know we're going to get into this with Mark Schlereth in this show, talking Seahawks, and Mark all the time talks about culture and how culture is always evolving and it is never a stagnant thing. It just felt like, man, this was such a resilient team at the bullpen, in the starting rotation. Jared Kelenic's ups and downs.
Do you think that resilience ends up transferring to next year? Because some stuff carries over, some stuff doesn't, right? I'm not going to sit here and tell you the bullpen's going to be as good next year because I've gone down that road before. You remember how good it was in 2014? Like, best ever. Carried them. It was one of the times they competed.
Oh, Mikey, you remember when we were doing the spring training games, sitting up in the booth.
Ricky Riz. 2015. It might have been.
Sit down.
Yes, with the idea that the bullpen was just going to be great again, and it wasn't. Unfortunately, Yorvis Medina, Dominic Leon,
the guy
Lucas
that
Litke,
brought the wine cellar, it wasn't.
That was so funny. It wasn't the same the next year. That was a unique thing where those guys all had career years. I don't know whether Paul Sewald is going to be as good next year as he was this year. He struggled a little bit at the end of the year. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Casey Sadler gives up more than a 0.67 ERA and doesn't have, 32 straight outings or whatever it was without giving up a run.
Shigetoshi Hasegawa.
It was unbelievable.
And maybe Drew Steckenrider.
Don't say that with such arrogance.
He might not be.
Kyle, you said that with such pompous.
We're getting shiggy with it, Brock.
There are some other positives. You're going to get Ken Giles. You're going to also get Munoz. Maybe you get some of the somebody else. I mean, so like maybe one of those guys repeats. Castillo should be better, I think, than he was at the end of the year. He should be healthier. So look, I'm not saying the bullpen's going to be bad next year, but I'm not going to count on it being all world, right? And Jerry knows that, and Scott knows that. What I take out of this year is not so much the resilience. So I thought that was great because it speaks to the culture that they've built. I think they found their core. I think they know that they now have some of the guys, because I think what J.P. Crawford did is sustainable. Certainly the defense is, the leadership is, and I don't think he did anything crazy that he's not capable of repeating with his bat, right? I think Haniger is sustainable, assuming he can stay healthy, and you've got another year there, and there's a conversation. I think what Kelenic did is more than sustainable. He should get better in his age 22 season. So I think they found some sustainable pieces. But listen to Jerry DePoto. This was on my interview with him last week. Talk about where they're at versus where they need to be. He knows they're not all the way there yet.
This was the idea, you know, to create something new and different. And from the rhetoric we used for so many years, we wanted to be young and sustainable and athletic. I think we have become that. And, you know, whether we can sustain 90-plus wins year in and year out, we still have some work to do, but we're getting there. And this has been so much fun to watch this group evolve and to see that the players driving it from the core are players that have been or will be here for many years.
They still have work to do to sustain 90-plus wins every year. Jerry's saying it out loud. Yep. It's not like he's hinting at it. He's saying it while Scott is saying the future is now. This is the biggest offseason in the history of the Mariners. It's not even close.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Say that again.
Well, I guess maybe certainly my history with the Mariners.
the year they added Sexton Beltre is a pretty big year.
Yeah. How'd that go?
It didn't go well, but it's a pretty big year.
Yeah, it was.
We're on the cusp.
What year was that? Like 2005?
2004?
It didn't go that poorly. Not to derail.
In retrospect, it went better.
Richie Sexton's horrible. He had like 40 home runs.
You'd kill for Richie Sexton on this team.
Yes.
Over the last couple of years. I know. But I think that this
is... It is the biggest since you've been here.
Here's why I'll answer that. Here's why I do think it is. Look, after 95, what you did to build on that, certainly after A-Rod leaves in 2000, I mean, like, there's a couple of other years that are really big, and they did good jobs of them. The difference here is that this is your first rebuild in forever, right? We can all agree this is the first time you've actually rebuilt. And now you've established the core, you've built up the farm system, you've built up the assets, you took down the payroll with the promise of bringing it back up. It's at like 35 to 40 million on the books for next year. So this is your chance to go take 90 and turn it into 95 or 100 wins and make this thing actually sustainable. Yeah, I think you can make an argument that this is the biggest offseason in the history of the Seattle Mariners because of what they've done the last few years ago and tearing it down to build back into it.
Mm-hmm. I think that is very fair. Can I confess something?
Yes. And bad for the reputation, good for the soul.
Yeah, and you can just rip me apart. You can go ahead. Just whatever you want to do. Destroy
I don't even
me.
Get credit for spitting back your line to you.
Thank you. You nailed it.
I've never Say heard you hear the word confession without saying bad for the reputation, good for the soul.
Good. God bless you. Way to go.
Brock, God blessed me. Nice.
Way to go, Salky.
Thanks, buddy.
I probably shouldn't say this. And I should probably have a better filter, but I'm not going to. Okay, because we're all friends here. Part of me is a little concerned about spending money. Part of me loves that this is a bunch of young, hungry dudes. Part of me loves that this is built more in the model right now of like Tampa Bay and Oakland. And Tampa Bay, many are predicting going to be the World Series again and maybe even champs this year. That there's just, I don't know. I know they've got holes. I also know that they've got waves of prospects coming, and I love that.
Brock. Tell me one team that doesn't also spend money. So let's last night we're recording
Oakland and
this
Tampa.
Wednesday.
Oakland and Tampa in the American League.
Okay.
Perennially, consistently in the playoffs, great the last decade.
Yes. And Oakland's been to has done how well in the playoffs and all those? You there's like look at Houston, look at Chicago, look at the Red Sox last night. We were watching the wild card game last night. Young core, homegrown with Devers and Bogarts, right? Who's the third member? Now, I mean, he's hurt, but who's the third member?
JD
Martinez. How'd you get him? Go spend the money. You need to do both. There is no reason for it to be one or the other. You're right. Spending money every year is how you end up like the Yankees. And what the Yankees can say, I heard them say, Brett Gardner, in his 16 years, has been in the playoffs 10 of them or something like that. I might have the numbers a little off, but it was something like that. He's 38 years old, which is insane to me. Why? Because they spend the money. They've won one World Series during that time. They've been to one World Series. Like, it's not like they've been incredible every year. But if you spend enough money on veterans, you'll be in the playoffs.
I'll middle ground you two guys.
Hold on. Before you do, I want to be middle grounded in a moment. But how many wins did the Mariners have in 2018, the year before they blew this up?
89.
One fewer than they had this year. They had one more win this year. Mm-hmm. But it feels different because you can get 89 wins if you just throw some money at a couple of veterans. You got Ryan Healy at first base. Never mind that, right?
Real major leaguers off the bench.
That's right. You just get a couple of bats and a couple of Mike Leakes of the world, and you can win 85 games or so. And if you get lucky, it gets to 89. But to truly be great, you need to spend the money on the veterans, and you need to have the young nucleus. And you need to have the assets to go get whatever else you might need at the deadline and beyond. And I think the point of the excitement level here is you've got the nucleus. I think what we saw with Kelnick was real. Crawford and the leadership, some of your young pitching. It now gives you more hope, I think, for Julio and for the other young pitchers that they have, that they've got an eye for this thing and that it may work. So that's one. Two, you've got the money, right? And three, you've got the best farm system in baseball to go get what you need to get. That's why you're so excited and why it's such a big offseason and why I would not be even a little bit worried about spending money.
I love the spending money, and I think I've been right there with you for years now. But I guess the middle ground to me is I would be nervous that if you go all in and you spend all your money and you commit yourself to one direction, if you get it wrong again.
You don't need hold on. No one is saying spend all $100 million on one guy. If you want to get to league average spending, you got to spend around $100 million, okay, just for a round number. No one's saying to give someone or two $50 million contracts. You can mix in some of the veterans. You need a bunch of guys. Maybe you're paying one guy 25 and then pay a bunch of guys 6, 8. You need the steady vet. Who carried your team this year? Haniger, Seager, France. I mean, they're all veterans for the most part. That's who carries a team over the course
Tyler
of the year.
Tyler Anderson.
Don't you need to go do that stuff?
Two concerns. Okay. Thank you for trying.
And not the cheap, risky ones like Paxton.
Yes.
What did you say you were going to do, Howdy? Middle ground you.
He middle grounded us.
Did you middle ground me?
He did. Yeah, you've been middle grounded.
Okay. Let me try to come back to small ball grounded?
Higher ground?
Bunt?
You just want to be on higher ground.
I just want to bunt?
Yeah.
You want the NFL model.
Here's what my concern is. Do you think it takes the same skill set for Jerry and Scott and your developmental team to make sure you get the right guys and the right veterans. And when you do spend, and it's not spending volume on middle class, you need a couple ringers. You need a couple difference makers. Is it the same skill set to make that decision as it is to do what you've done now, building these waves of prospects?
I don't know that it
okay,
might
hold
not
on,
be,
hold
but
that
I,
thought.
But,
just re-
okay.
Hold that thought for a second.
Yes.
And then secondly,
yes.
You bring a turd in. What will that do to JP and Mitch?
Well, I agree with that. You don't want to be bring. I mean, I don't think I'm sitting here saying spend on turds.
But if you're $30 million guy, yeah, has a little bit of a question mark,
get the right
and it
guy.
Turns out to be wrong.
You got to go get the right guys.
Because all money does is make you more of what
right.
you already are.
So Carlos Correa might not be the player that I'm pointing at and saying that's the dude I want, right? I mean, like, you've got
whiny.
Yeah, and I've heard some of those questions about Semien, and I don't know enough about him to know whether that's real or not.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's folks who point to Chris Bryant, and they would like him. I mean, Javi Baez is a question mark, right? Obviously, he had the booing in New York, although I think the world of him. I think he's a heck of a player.
The sucky thing about money and what money can do and why the Bible talks more about money than anything else is because it ruins situations. And it's not only that it makes maybe a bad guy a worse guy. My concern is then we all pointed to JP last week, right? We said it this week on your show talking about JP and who's the guy. And we love that sound of JP saying what? Like, this is my team now.
Yep.
This is my team.
Yep.
Well, what does money do if you bring in a $150 million guy and JP is still what on his arbitration years?
$3 million.
Yeah.
What's JP going to do?
Yeah,
heartbeat at this team.
I think it depends the type of guy you bring in. I think your concerns are not illegitimate, Brock.
Okay,
I think
good.
Those are some very real right, concerns. Not
right, reputation's okay.
Yes.
Whew.
No, I think those are fair, but I don't think that can stop you from getting better. At the end of the day, they did a great job with smoke, mirrors, chemistry, and magic this year, and it got them to 90. And yes, that almost got them a wild card, but let's be real. The goal is not a wild card. The goal is to win the World Series.
Yep.
To win a World Series, you got to be as talented as Chicago, as talented as Houston, as talented as LA, as talented, right? I mean, like, that's what makes you a World Series contender. That's the goal. And you need more talent to get there. If you want to go spend that money, maybe you do it on pitching. Maybe if you're worried about the, you know, clubhouse chemistry issues, maybe it's Zach Greinke is one of the first guys you target and say, okay, I want this guy. By all accounts, a great dude, doesn't seek the spotlight. Obviously, the opposite of it. He's had some mental health concerns that he's talked about publicly and anxiety and doesn't want any of that, is happy to cede the spotlight to anybody else. But you're going to need, look, you got to replace Kyle Seager's production. You think you're going to do that with Abraham Toro and nothing else?
Yeah, 40 dingers and
right.
100
I mean, like,
RBIs.
And I think you can do better than Kyle Seager. I think he gave you about a 2 war this year, 2 wins. Kyle Seager's war this year was roughly the equivalent of Mike Trout's. Trout hasn't played since May. So I understand a lot of the Kyle Seager love. I will never participate in it because I am loyal to my friend Brock, and I think what Kyle did to Brock is unseemly. That's how I feel. Hey. You can laugh at me all you want.
I love you.
What?
And Kyle? Is Kyle in the room still?
No, he just walked out.
How many more pictures does Kyle have on
me? I know.
His secret pictures? His
yes.
TMZ side job?
Where did he go? Oh, it's funny. It's convenient. He left the room knowing we're probably going to go in this direction.
I'm not participating in the Kyle Seager love fest. I thought it was a nice moment. I'm glad they gave him the base. I don't know if Lloyd McClendon okayed that or not, but like, I'm glad to see that Kyle was honored, and he deserved it. He's a better guy than I give him credit for, and clearly his teammates love him, and something maybe has changed with him in the last few years. I still don't appreciate the way he handled the Brock thing. I thought it was wrong. Brock said fair things about Kyle Seager on the radio doing his job, and Seager not only wouldn't got mad about it, wouldn't even talk to him about it and accept a conversation and apology. That doesn't make sense to me.
Okay.
So
right,
I got my boys back over here. Sorry.
Signed, sealed, delivered. Put the Salk stamp on it. It is done.
Yeah, that's how it is. Sorry.
Hey, you're fair. You are who you are.
And you can absolutely replace that production, but not for free. What Kyle Seager did this year, 35 home runs and 100 RBI, it maybe the on-base percentage wasn't there with it to create a great OPS, and he's sort of up and down. And his defense is not what it used to be. It used to
be
plus-plus.
Very solid, but it's not elite.
Exactly. So you need to go replace that. And Abraham Toro was a butcher so far at second base and was awful after the first couple of weeks that he was here.
Do you think that Love Fest was in any way to maybe, well, I guess Corey signed his deal in L.A., didn't he?
There's no chance, dude. There's no way Corey would have been coming here. I don't think he signed a deal yet, but he's not coming here, not after all that. You don't not speak to your GM and then have him be like, yeah, but I'm going to sign your brother. I don't see that going down.
King of Thrones kind of thing.
So, Brock, so do you not want to spend, or do you just want to spend wisely? Because I agree with you. I think the trade market will be a big part of this.
I do. Now, Tampa goes on and wins the World Series this year. Then it's like, wow, man, they were in the World Series last year. They win it this year. Maybe there is some genius to what they're doing there and how they do have waves of prospects and how they, you know, kind of cut out a bunch of the crap that comes with money, frankly.
It's weird, too, because we watched Tampa play the Mariners, what, 6-7 times this year?
Yes.
And they look like garbage.
Right.
Like, I can't even fathom that they're as good as they are based on the games that I watched them play against the Mariners. I know they won a whole lot of other ones, but God, the Mariners made them look silly.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the same with the A's. They had like almost as much success against Tampa as they did over Oakland.
To Brock's point, the A's and the Rays, they're not carried by stars in any aspect of the game.
Well, I would say that the A's are. The A's only good player is Matt Olson.
Well, yeah, but I mean, their starting pitching is solid.
Yeah.
Their bullpen is okay.
Got to have a good, yeah, they have a good starting staff.
But their offense has never been.
No, it's just Matt Olson.
But now it's Matt Olson.
And that's why they don't do anything else. Like, they need more talent on the A's. We watch some of those guys at the bottom of their order.
I mean, is that money?
They need more talent.
I guess what would probably, again, I just kind of point to JP, and I've said that since like May. I was probably way over bloated on what I thought the meaning he was to his team. I don't think WAR does it total justice, and his edge and his energy and all of that and his hunger and his resiliency, right? His career wasn't a cakewalk, right? And to get to this point now, and clearly, right, as he's kind of crying with Angie Mentink there at the end of the year, like, yeah, man, this is my team.
Hey, while we're just throwing some credit around, can we throw a little at Angie? I was saying the other day, I think that Angie Mentink, as far as post-game interviewers, she might be the best I've ever heard.
Mm.
I mean, there's a lot of people who are good at that job. It's not an easy job. Shannon does a great job at it, too. I don't mean to diminish anybody else.
Baseball, by far, is the hardest.
But in terms of doing it on TV, gosh, I don't know that I've ever seen anyone do it as comfortably and get as much out of people as Angie does because of her knowledge of the game. There are probably a few others, certainly in baseball. I mean, obviously, you know, what's his name with the suits? Craig Sager was great at it for
Pedro
a long
Gomez
time.
Was also
he was. There, so there's some other really good ones. So this is not like it's just her and nobody else. But especially at the local level, for Angie to be that good getting those kinds of post-game interviews, I think it's remarkable.
Yes, I would agree with
that. It's really impressive.
The ease that she puts her guest in, and then her knowledge.
Yes.
And then the comfort. So she can get that from JP, and frankly, Angie was kind of emotional.
Absolutely she was. The two of them together, yes, crying their eyes out.
Yeah. And I think that's real, you know, like you asked earlier, what's real? Has he moved this thing forward? And you asked Jerry about it, and what's real? So I think that's a unique dynamic, man. Are you going to bring in Simeon? Are you going to bring in, because a bunch of these other free agents, Correa and others, are kind of middle infielders and do that, and he's going to be a two-time Gold Glover, and he is the juice, man. So do you bring in an outfielder? Do you bring in a DH? Do you bring in a pitcher? Do you bring in somebody that is not going to mess with that dynamic?
I'll tell you,
because we've not had that. Okay, you can say this is the biggest Mariners offseason. I can equally say, Mike, for 15 years of doing this, we have not had a player with an edge. We've not had a player say, this is my team.
True.
We've not had a player that brings that kind of dynamic is bringing.
Yes, I totally agree. You can't mess with that. And if you were to go get, let's say, Trevor Story, he's going to have to go play third. Like, you don't want to mess with what J.P. Crawford means and his spot in the clubhouse right now. No, I agree with that. So you got to be careful. You got to do it the right way, but also you need talent. And that's ultimately what's going to win. I'll tell you what's real. The Ascend Prime Steak and Sushi third annual Dia de los Muertos lounge party.
Ooh,
how about this?
Yes.
Saturday, October 30th, day before Halloween.
Day of the Dead.
8 to 11. Unearth an affair full of light and color celebrating Dia de los Muertos. On the 31st floor, no better place to do it at Ascend Prime Steak and Sushi. Elevate your evening in the lounge and let the nighttime view take your breath away while specialty cocktails give you new life. You can indulge in an atmosphere unlike any other. Would you like to hear what they'll have there that night?
Please, go ahead.
Would you like some of the details?
Uh-huh.
All right. Music. Acclaimed local DJ Chris Charma. You got all night happy hour.
Ooh.
All night. All so night. Stick in happy hour all night. So it's happy hour all night.
You do happiest. This night for your kids, the next night for Halloween.
Right. This night for yourself. The next night's for the kids.
Yes.
Sure.
Thank you.
You got a costume contest and prizing. I'm sure that if you're going to be on the 31st floor, you're coming with some sort of an impressive costume. VIP bottle service, specialty beverages, 360-degree photo booth. That's kind of cool. How does that work? Those are hip. How does that work? 360? That'd be interesting. Multiple experiences throughout the lounge, private dining rooms, much more. But they don't want to ruin the surprise. There's more, but I can't tell it all to you because there's too many surprises. And I think that's sort of like the whole vibe of Dia de los Muertos. So you can learn more. You can get your tickets. You can book your VIP table all at ascendprime.com.
Do you think when Schlereth's producer calls people and says, hey, you know, this is Schlereth's producer, does he say
Mike and Mark? I don't know.
Mike and Mark's producer. What does he say, Stink?
He says, hey, this is Stink's producer. And yes. He leaves Mike out of it because he knows. People don't want to come on with Mike. They just want to come on with me. So.
Do you think Howdy's doing the same thing that he basically had to beg you?
So I think basically what he's telling you is people don't want to come on with you is what that's basically what I'm reading into. Right
I don't
now.
Think that you need to do much but reading into it to get there, Mark. I think we all pretty well know that's the case.
You know what? You got to play your role, man.
Yeah.
You know what? Everybody's got a role and you got to play it.
Yeah. Yeah, lucky me. I'm so glad this gets to be my role, apparently, forever and ever.
You just take your lot in life.
Yeah.
This is what you do.
Uh-huh. You just kind of deal with it. Yeah. How are you, Mark? What's going on in your world? It's good to have you on the show.
It's great to be on with you guys, man. Everything is good. You know, this time of year for all of us, it's just busy. So always bouncing around, always, you know, always got my nose in a... in film and trying to be the best I can be, which, you know, I pale in comparison to most, but at least I work hard. So I've got that going for me.
Well, you know, despite everybody ripping me and saying how horrible I am to work with and all that, I really enjoyed listening to you over the weekend. I think you and Adam are a great team, and I thought you guys were great together. Thanks for doing a good broadcast.
I appreciate it. You know, I was really interested to see. I knew that Seattle would respond to some degree on the defensive side of the ball because that's probably as poorly the week previous as I've ever seen them on tape. They were completely out of sorts. Lack of communication, lack of aggressiveness. I mean, you name it, anything you want to put on them, it was apparent. And talking to, you know, Jamal Adams, talking to Pete Carroll, talking to Ken Norton before the game, you know, there's in no uncertain terms, they were embarrassed what they put on tape. And I will tell you this, there's not one of us who's ever played this game who hasn't put something on tape that's embarrassing and respond to that. So I knew there would be a response from Seattle, and they certainly did that on the defensive side of the ball without question. And once they got going offensively, you know, they did the same there.
So what was it, Mark? Was it personnel? They switch out a corner. They put a new dime personnel. Was it scheme? Was it a little bit more man than the zone and the soft zone they played the previous 2 weeks? Or was it just flat-out pride and effort? If those three are a pie chart, as you watched that game unfold last weekend versus the week prior, what do you think from a percentage standpoint? Scheme, personnel, pride, effort?
I think pride effort would be far and away the biggest part. And then a little, and not so much changing the scheme. Like, you don't really ever change your scheme as much as you adjust how you play the scheme. It's the nuances of what you do. So, for instance, if you're going to play, you know, cover three, and it's going to be a match depending on the route combination, you know, anything vertically, you're going to match man to man. Can you play that in more of a press? Can you get your hands on the receiver? Can you bump and run? Can you play a little bit more aggressively? And I think that's what you saw. Change your personnel. They flip-flop the size of the corners. And you know, they benched Trey Flowers. So that was a change in personnel. But ultimately, I think the biggest thing was just play your responsibility and play it more aggressively. The other thing that I think was a change is to make sure you're underneath coverage, whether that's Brooks or whoever, get your depth. You know, don't get sucked up on, don't bite the cheese on the underneath stuff. Don't put yourself in that conflict to where you can't create at least a play on the ball when they're running a basic behind you or they're running a dig behind you. Make sure you play from high to low and be able to trigger on that underneath stuff and shut it down for 3 yards. And I think those are the things. It's the nuanced adjustments, I think, Brock, that they made that were the difference in that game against San Francisco.
So how much of it is real moving forward, and how much of it was Jimmy Garoppolo, and even more so a rookie Trey Lance in his first start? How believable are some of the gains that they made?
Well, I think just from playing the techniques aggressively, I think that's real, and I think that follows. Now, I think you also have to understand how San Francisco is built. They are not one of those teams that, Minnesota the week before, whether it's Jefferson or whether it's Thielen, those guys you can spread and you can get a favorable matchup on one of those guys and you can attack that matchup. Like, that's something that is tangible. That's something that you can feel. Those guys are great route runners. Those guys can do that. San Francisco truly isn't built that way. All their explosive plays really don't come off of one-on-one matchups. It's really more about scheme. And it's about designing big plays, because I don't think, whether it's Ayuk or whether it's Deebo Samuel, I don't think they're the greatest route runners. But what they are is unbelievably dynamic in space when they catch the ball. And so they're designed a little bit differently. So we'll see if it translates when you get, those tough matchups, when you're faced against another guy who is an incredibly sublime route runner and has got size and speed to take advantage of you. But it was a great starting point, if you will.
How are Pete and Russ? You mentioned Ken Norton. You mentioned Jamal Adams. You mentioned some of the defensive personnel. Obviously, Pete has his hands, fingerprints all over that side of the ball. But there were a lot of conversation about the offense and the offensive struggles in the second half of games heading into San Francisco. They flipped that script. How were Pete and Russ to sit down with?
They were great. Russ is always great. He's always positive. He's always moving forward. He always has a plan in his mind. It's so funny to listen to him, how he writes out his report on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and how he tries to quiz the players on the offensive side of the ball by putting in things that aren't real. And to make sure the guys are actually reading it. And that stuff is funny to me, because it's a game. Then it becomes, like, those things become games, right? And you know how this is in a locker room. It's all about how much fun you can have, the kind of games that you play. It's serious. You work really hard, but there's got to be some levity in any locker room. So I found that, just incredibly human.
What do you mean, Mark, by that? I think people are going to hear that and have no idea what notes mean, what any of that means. Do you have any example? Right. Can you give it from your experience? What did that look like?
Right. So, like Russ was saying, that, hey, man, when I write a report, I always put in some things to try to catch my guys sleeping to see if anybody notices. So he put in a scouting report, and he said in my scouting report, now Russ is unique in that I've never heard anybody else do this. He spends all day Monday, Tuesday, and Sunday nights looking at the game, the previous game, or the game they just played, and then scouting the opponent. And he writes these reports that are 14, 15 pages long. And, he breaks down the positions, breaks down the matchups, breaks down the blitzes, and essentially puts this scouting report together. And so he number 49, you got to watch out for number 49, and it's the mascot of the Niners. Whatever that mascot, I don't even know.
Sourdough Sam.
Sourdough Sam, there you go. And so he puts it in there to see if guys pick up on it and if guys are really reading the report thoroughly and are paying attention. And, that just becomes one of those little stupid games that you kind of play in a locker room that, like I said, bring levity, bring, fun to your group. I used to, I would always be in at 5 o'clock in the morning, hanging something in somebody's locker, changing a name tag, whatever it is you do to get under guys' skin and just to have a good time with them. And so that stuff bonds it together, those little, stupid reindeer games, as we used to call them. So I really appreciate that, the human side of Russ, that I think he can be so businesslike when he's on the field and so stoic, you know, in front of a mic sometimes, that there is that human element. And I really am a big believer. You know, we talk about chemistry. We talk about culture. We talk about leadership. But those are the things to me that really matter and really establish that stuff. And, you know, it has to be worked on. It's not stagnant. Culture in your program is alive, right? It's not static. It's alive. It's constantly moving. And you have to continue to move that needle, continue to grow those relationships. And I really appreciate that about Russ. And I really appreciate the collectiveness between he and Shane Waldron and what they're trying to accomplish together. It really is, let's build this offense, you know, together, and let's meld kind of our philosophy with your philosophy and make sure that we're all on the same page. And that part, to me, is the way things should be structured. And they take time, to be sure, but you could see there's a chemistry building there.
I'm surprised they went sourdough. Why not go with one of the sea lions that are right outside the Ghirardelli Square there? Like that, the sea lions seem like an obvious bet for one of those mascots, no?
Yeah, you would think that, but you know, the sourdough Sam thing has been there forever.
All right.
And
so have those sea lions.
And listen, you know,
park right there on those those docks.
Yeah, the sea lions have probably been there longer than we have, right?
Exactly.
I would imagine, since it's nature and everything.
Yes, right.
But you know, they're cute. Sourdough Sam, though, I mean, it's Gold Rush Town, right? I mean,
that's
it goes
fair.
All the way back to whenever it goes back to. I don't know. I'm not a history major. Actually, I'm a general studies
I'm guessing
major.
It goes back to, like, 1849, I would think. I think that's why they call them the 49ers.
Yeah.
No? It seems like right around the time.
See, there you go again, being a jerk.
I know.
You wonder why.
This is why Mark doesn't want to talk to me. Yeah.
And you wonder why people don't like you.
I know. It's obnoxious comments like that one. Hey, speaking of people not being liked, Pete Carroll gets a lot of grief for things that it seems like other people in the game have no problems getting away with. I don't know if you saw any of Brandon Staley's comments this week. He was asked about, you know, the running game and the importance of it, and essentially talked all about how you have to have that physical part of the game. If you're just a passing team, it doesn't do anything. But he's cool, and he's from the young school of throwing the ball, so he can get away with saying exactly what Pete does, which is complete the circle of toughness by running the ball also. Why doesn't Pete get the benefit of the doubt on that?
It's a good question. You know, I really don't know. I mean, I don't think Pete, you know, the thing I love about Pete is I don't think he really cares. And I've talked to Pete about, you know, I've talked to Pete about this specifically, not about his, you know, not about how people look at him or view him in the media, but just running the ball. And we had this conversation last year where he's like, "Stink, man, it's coming full circle. We're going to get back to 90s football, just like, you know, or like the dinosaur that you are," type of thing, and how it used to be. And you know how cyclical the league is. He believes in that. And I think part of it, too, is because, you know, there's this narrative of let Russ cook. And, you know, Russ is the most sacked quarterback in football over the last however many years. I mean, that guy consistently takes about 45 sacks a game a year. And so you're trying to take some of that pressure off. And, you know, one of the things that Brandon Staley said that I've always believed in, and I've had this conversation with multiple coaches, can I take the mental load off my quarterback 12 to 15 times a game? And I'm talking in the passing game. Can I take that mental load off my quarterback where I can give you essentially a playoff? And I'm not just talking about handing it off, but I'm talking about when you're running the ball really well, the boot keep game where, you know, you have this linear progression of, you know, pin flat and you have a you know, a shallow cross and then you have some type of deep comeback and it's all lined up 1-2-3 half field read. And like that, you should essentially be, you know, 12 for 12 with no stress on those 12 passes, theoretically, if you're running it well. And that's part of taking the pressure off your quarterback, taking the pressure off of him and giving him a mental rest. Because let me tell you, like, the more you study this game and the more you realize what's on the quarterback's plate, it's like, it's incredible to know, you know, to get the call in there in your helmet, there's crowd noise. You've got to basically lay out you got to lay out the formation. You got to lay out the potential of the check, the can it with some other play. So you've got this whole long play call, the protection. You've got to understand what the protection is, how you change the protection, how you re-identify the mic. Then you have to know all five eligibles. Where are they? Then as you drop back, you're reading the coverage, and you have to say, hey, man, this is the coverage area, and I know this side's no good. Let me get to the backside. And you got to do all that in 2 or 3 seconds. It's overwhelming how much is on the quarterback's plate. So as a coach, if you can take 12 or 15 plays off of that, and say, here's a no-stress play for you. Here's a no-stress play for you. How much better are you going to be in the long run? And I know that Pete understands that. And he probably doesn't get the credit he deserves for being a hard-nosed, kind of tough, competitive coach.
Hey, my last thing for you, Stink, because I know you just devour all of that game tape, and it's early enough in the year that you can kind of look at probably every game heading into this one. I'm just curious how you would grade and evaluate the line of scrimmage. The Seahawk offensive line, kind of where they sit with what you've seen in the league, and maybe just as importantly, because Pete believes it, that defensive line and how it ties that team together.
Yeah, I think offensive line-wise, you've seen breakdowns, and some of that is the lack of consistency in their run game, and they get into a situation, second halves, where they have to throw it a little bit more. So, you know, when you're getting into those predictable situations, it takes your aggressiveness out. So I have the opportunity to consult for several teams across the league. And one of the things I always talk to teams about is taking the passive out of pass protection. And to be able to do that, it's not just about running the game or running the ball. It's about having the threat of run in third downs, right? Third down and four minus. So there is that duality. So if I get a five-step drop, even with a hitch, I can still attack the line of scrimmage in a pass play and essentially make a defender defend that. And now I win automatically because that ball is going to be gone before you can start your second move, before you can actually reestablish yourself as a pass rusher. So when you get predictable, it puts much more onus on the offensive line. I think they're progressing on the defensive side of the ball. I think they're stout in the middle. They don't have what I used to call, well, used to call here in Denver, a war daddy. And a war daddy is that one dude that you have to double team every time you break the huddle. That you have to find and say, how are we going to contend with that guy? Because that guy can wreck the line of scrimmage. Seattle doesn't have that guy. So you're never worried about getting five guys out and going 5-0 and just figuring a point protection where we say, hey, that's the mic. No, let's change it to that guy and say, if we're in 5 1-on-1s, we'll hold up. And that really is the biggest issue in my mind with Seattle. Can you develop somebody on that line of scrimmage who's an absolute menace that you can trust to get to the quarterback, that you have to, as an offense, double team? And until that guy develops, or they find that guy, or somebody, you know, grows into that role, they're always going to have a little bit of an issue when it comes to rushing the passer and how you work on the back end.
It's good stuff. I totally agree with all of that. It makes perfect sense. I also have some history for you here, Mark. I don't know if you know this. Did you know Sourdough Sam was not the first 49ers mascot?
No, was it Yosemite?
No, well before that, in the 50s and 60s, this is true, their first mascot was a mule named Clementine that wore a red saddle blanket.
Right, because Clementine did the work as they were cutting through the trail on the gold rush. He was the one that you were packing down, saddlebagging
right.
It, and he was doing the majority of the work, and you were just kind of walking or sitting on him.
Yes.
So I appreciate it. You know what? Clementine was the offensive line
yep.
of the 50s,
yep.
and he just got kicked to the curb
yeah.
because he's not sexy enough.
That's right. They needed
to go back to Clementine.
So apparently Sourdough Sam is sexy enough. That's what I've learned out of the interview today. Mark, thank you.
I tell you what, who doesn't love a ginger mascot with a swell beard? Everybody does, I think.
Thanks, Mark. Good to talk to you, man. We always love catching up with you. You can hear Mark on our sister station, The Fan in Denver, and he does a great job with Adam Amin on Fox. Thanks, man. We appreciate it.
You got it, guys. Take care.
Thank you, Stink. Hey, Mark, before you go, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Trump tied us off last week at school. Your story about your horse growing up that was able to shut his door
Right, yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh, I was laughing at. What was the name of that horse?
Victor. He's the damnedest thing, Brock. I mean, he was, the guy had personality like you wouldn't believe. Anyhow, yeah, 100% true. Like a lot of my stories aren't true. They're just stories, but that one's 100% true.
Oh, right, there you go. There's Mark Schlereth. And dude, Stink's a fun guy. He really is. He's great stories and just fun to talk to. But there's some good stuff in there. He obviously really knows his football. Heck, he's consulting for a bunch of NFL teams. I mean, it's not like Mark doesn't know what he's talking about just because he's a fun guy.
Mike, I've not told you I do a lot of consulting for college teams in the offseason.
Do you? And, you know, it's are you consulting for UW on how to stop the run?
Well,
no? Are you consulting with Nick Rolovich for PR? Because those things are both going great.
No, neither of them have hired me.
Oh, that's too bad. Nick's doing really well with the PR.
No, I do a lot of consulting for Nick Saban, for Kirby Smart.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Jim Harbaugh hired me this offseason. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's been working out well for you.
Sounds like you must have stopped. I didn't hear Dabo in there. So, based off Clemson's start, you've distanced yourself.
Yeah, not this year with Dabo. No, not this year with Dabo.
Nick Rolovich managed to split apart the Cougs. Like, how do you manage
the Cougs are unified. We all hate Nick Rolovich.
Well, all right. So it's that. So he's unified the Cougs?
Yes.
Sheesh. What a mess.
Bro, get him out of here.
Win. What are you talking about? They got it done down in Berkeley.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're mad about. Yeah.
They beat the team that lost to UW. Yeah.
They're not in last place.
No, doing fine. Anyway, Brock, what did you want to say about Mark?
Well, I love the line that he said that when he does consult, and this is so good, and it plays in. I'm glad you also brought up that Brandon Staley sound, because I heard that, and I immediately had the exact same thought you did, the head coach of the Chargers. He basically just said it in the new age way. He just packaged it for all the analytics people to say, yeah, you're right, yeah. Huh? But also, too, you don't need to run play action. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's a younger, hipper, I guess, appeasing to the analytical crowd, whereas Pete has too much water under the bridge and it makes him upset.
Or they already hate him.
And he can't change that narrative. But I liked his line that he said in there when he does consult, to take the passive out of pass protection. And as he said that, I wrote it down. I'll probably have to steal that and use it. I'll give him credit for a while and then until I make it my own, because I'm sure he did the same with Alex Gibbs, and he heard that before somewhere else. But it makes sense. And frankly, in this matchup Thursday night in prime time against the Rams, if you think about and just close your eyes, the number of times that offensive line has been so passive, has been backpedaling, has tried to double team, has tried to triple team Aaron Donald, right? They have not been able to just take the starch out of them. They haven't been able very many times to just hammer them. And when they have beaten them, it is when they have been the aggressors, when they have been the attackers, when they've not been predictable. But if they get into the situation like they did last year in the playoff game, like they've done a number of times, it's the only team that Russell has a losing record against. He is 8-10 against them. I think Pete is like 5-10 against McVay or something ridiculous, or Aaron Donald. Like, if they get into that, hey man, we're going to back up. We're going backwards. You're dead. You're not going to beat him. He and Floyd and crew are going to destroy you if you can do what Arizona did the other day on Sunday, and that is have some, as Mark said, duality.
They ran for over 200 yards against them. Duality. Whenever they've had success against the Rams, it's been run at Aaron Donald, make him defend the run rather than teeing off against the pass. And generally, that's
Leonard Floyd.
Well, right. Generally, that's been sort of the Chris Carson thing. I don't know how healthy Chris Carson's going to be this week. So is that an Alex Collins thing? Does that work as well without the sort of punishing power back? Or can it work with sort of what Alex Collins brings to the table?
Was it Homer in the playoff game last year?
Was it?
I believe it was.
That's not a good sign.
No, it wasn't. And they had no duality. They had no threat in those guys. And coming out of that game, you'll remember Pete saying, you know, one thing we have to fix is teams can't play two safeties against us. And if they do, then we haven't done our job. We've lost the very essence of who we are and the very conviction of which we play, and we're not going to win. So you'll see in the electric lime green, whatever they wear.
Action green
on Thursday night. If the Rams just watch pre-snap, it's usually a broad enough look. And if those Rams have two safeties that are sitting at 10 and 12 yards, and they can bracket, and they can double, and they can disguise, and they can fool with Russell post-snap, because everything Mark said about playing the QB position pre-snap is hard. And then it's post-snap, and they, over the years, have complicated that picture and made it just brutal for Russell. And if they're able to do that, the Seahawks aren't going to beat them. You're going to chalk it again. It's another loss to Aaron Donald, another loss to Floyd, another loss for Pete against McVay. And, you know, we'll start the whole narrative of, oh, the sky's fallen once again.
You know, it's interesting the way all of that comes back to the quarterback. We know that everything in the NFL is about the quarterback, but it's easy to forget, right? Because you start talking about, well, running the ball this and it helps with this and that. No, as soon as Mark starts saying, well, all of that is just built to give the quarterback a few plays off mentally so that he can just focus on those other plays, it just really does go to show you that even when it's about running,
yes,
it's still about the quarterback.
Most important
position in all the sports, most complicated, most fascinating, most everything, it's the quarterback. And every single thing in the game is built around it.
And then when he is special, as he was in the drive before half, and he is around the red zone, it just compensates and overcomes lots of other issues. The way that I had framed that before this season, what I was most excited about was Giddens, right?
You said that the same thing, yes.
What Mark said about, hey, taking a little pressure off, just, hey, can I have some of these plays where they're freebies for me? It's the exact same concept. How many gimmies can you create?
They haven't been creating as many of them.
No, they have not.
Although I'll tell you what, the touchdown to DK, I know that like the Freddie Swain touchdown, that's Howdy's guy. I know Howdy's like, once again, it only happened because they forgot that Freddie Swain existed because he's so terrible.
I'm ready to turn the corner on that.
Oh, really?
That's small potatoes to what we're doing right now. It's small potatoes.
But you're ready to admit ready that Freddie Swain's okay.
It's not the center of this podcast.
No.
I'm ready to turn the corner. We can talk about it another time.
Another time. Maybe we'll build a whole podcast hour over it. Howdy's big change on Freddie Swain.
Confessions. We haven't done confessions.
Vinny Catricalla and Freddie Swain. They're in the Howdy category.
I'm ready to turn the page.
That play is ridiculous. Vintage Russ. Mora was making fun of me this week because I was saying, do you ever get worried that we're going to forget about or that Russell's won't get credit for all of his great plays because they all run together? And she's like, what are you staying up at night thinking about it? Like, all right,
so the world problems that Mike is like, but Heather, no one will remember.
I know.
He did the pirouette.
Right. I don't remember. So I'm probably worried that I won't remember. It's my own issues with my memory. But we've seen that play. There's so many plays like that from Russ. Right, Houdini act, run to the side, hit a guy in the corner of the end zone, he makes a nice catch, touchdown. The DK touchdown was awesome. That was like the move the DK put on that guy and just the cleanliness of the whole thing was amazing.
Absolutely. And I will say this,
that was a gimme.
Yes, it was a gimme. You know what else had been gimmies for him? And I saw that the PFF Seahawks tweeted this out.
Oh, PFF Seahawks.
You see Russell's play action numbers?
No. Are they good?
They're just absolutely insane. First in the league at 96.5 grade. He's 28 for 33 for 447 yards, 2 touchdowns, and they're a turnover. I mean, he hasn't had a turnover anyway. But he's been spectacular in that play action, which, again, to Mark's point about being, you know, not passive but be on the attack, guess what play action pass does? And I know, Brandon Staley said it. Analytics, don't get mad. I know. You don't have to run the ball to have successful play action. But boy, when you do, and it is the exact same look, and you can come out and you can attack, and you also let your old linemen tee off, Mike, so they're not retreating. They're not in passive mode. What kind of game is this? Is TE stunt? Where's the looper? What kind of blitz am I getting? Nope. I take all that off the plate, and we're going to run play action. I want you to come off the ball just like we do in the run game. You also give those guys up front, especially in a matchup like this on Thursday night on national television, you can give them a little bit of a gimme. You can give them a little bit of a break. You can free them up to tee off on Aaron Donald instead of him teeing off on
you. I kind of threw that play at you because, as you know, now I just compare you and Hasselbeck every Wednesday. Uh-huh. And we mentioned that play with Matt. What kind of a route do you think he called that from DK? I was just curious if you guys use the same terminology.
Okay, hold on. I'm trying to remember that. I have the wizardry play. DK's was a what? Was that
he
the
came
first?
Out of the slot and from the left side.
That the first touchdown?
Yes, through a ridiculous move on whoever was covering him. Cut
was
to
it
the
a
middle.
Dino?
He did not say Dino.
What did he say?
He said slop.
Oh, a sloppy Seattle, huh? Okay.
He called it a as in a slot or slant option.
Interesting.
Slop.
Interesting. Good.
You go Dino. What does Dino mean?
Oh, I'm still trying to picture random words.
No.
It's a bam bam. Pebbles. No, that was pebbles.
Well, it was scissors, rattler, Dino. There's a few different terms.
Okay.
A slop, slant option. Oh, I like that.
Yeah, I did too. I thought it was cool. A little slant option. And then, by the way, Russell's other touchdown, the third one, was the running touchdown where he had his like second fastest time in years. He does legitimately look faster.
What did he time out at?
It was like 19 miles an hour or something.
Okay.
It was faster than Deebo Samuel on his touchdown.
Jeez, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Dude.
Slim Russ.
Yeah, forget Slender about getting Russ. Caught by Tom, whatever that guy's name was. Tom Johnson,
local
the accountant.
CPA.
I was going to say Tom
State
Murphy.
State Farm Insurance.
Yeah. Like, Russ looked pretty quick. So give him some kudos there.
And he also popped Kinlaw's calf or knee or hammy or
What's
something.
Going on with everybody's calf this year?
Yeah, we talked about that. What did John Clayton say?
He didn't know.
But also, too, let's put it this way. Hydration?
Pretty much what he said.
Okay.
This is Brock and Salk's Blue 88.
Blue 88! Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Huard breaks down three football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
All right, let's finish up here with a little Blue 88, Brock. We don't get to do this as much. You're missing your signature moment that you used to have.
Well, it was either this or mean tweets, and I'm just not getting as many mean tweets these days either.
Well, you're not doing big enough games, obviously.
Well, actually, this weekend, Ohio State. So next week, Howdy, get ready. No matter what I say, no matter what I do, I'm going to anger a lot of the Buckeye
Some of them
faithful.
From G, probably, I would think. Maybe. We'll get a mean tweet or two from G, so we'll see how that goes. All right, question number one, Blue 88. Brock, what in the world has happened to LJ Collier? Why isn't he playing?
The word that just constantly pops in my head, it popped in my head a couple years ago, 3 years ago when he was drafted, is he is just a tweener. He's a tweener. And he was a tweener in college. I saw him at TCU. He was a good player. He was obviously a much more dominant player in college. I wouldn't even say dominant. I never watched LJ Collier and went, wow, he's dominant. He was never what Mark Schlereth said. Wow, he's a war daddy. You got to make sure you account for LJ Collier. This was in the Big 12. This isn't intramurals, brother. I mean, it is the Big 12. But even in the Big 12, he was never a war daddy. So you take him in the first round, and the label was, well, he's Michael Bennett, right? He's a jack of all trades. Maybe he's a master of none, and he's never going to be a war daddy. But at least he's versatile. He can play inside. He can play outside. He can wear a bunch of different hats. I think we're learning that Michael Bennett was pretty unique. Right, we've had this conversation. I feel like we've tried to kind of put that brand on a bunch of different players through the years. And you're like, no, Michael Bennett was just—he was a different dude, man. He was a special, special talent. And LJ is just a tweener. He's not fast enough, and explosive, and twitchy enough to be a war daddy on the outside. And then he is not quite big enough to be a three or one technique inside. And, you know, Rasheem Green in some ways was a little bit of a tweener. I kind of put those guys in a somewhat similar vein, but Rasheem Green's a lot bigger. He's a lot longer. I think he's stronger. So I think just unfortunately for LJ, he's been a healthy scratch. May not be the case Thursday night because Benson Mayo was banged up. So this may open the door. And you may get a furious LJ Collier in prime time on Thursday night.
I hope so.
I hope so, too.
At times he's made plays. I mean, he's not...
He's made very few.
He's made a couple of big plays. But he's made a couple of big plays, which tell me that there's something in there.
Well, there's effort. There's want to. There's desire. This is not a bust of effort. This is not a, hey, man, I'm just shutting it down. This is not a lazy. No. This is just simply, man, my physical traits that I have, this God, you know, what God gave me is just right in between an NFL defensive tackle inside guy and an NFL defensive end. It usually hits guys, frankly, in college, Mike. That's usually where you find a lot of tweeners, right? And they end up being, okay, I can be kind of a productive collegiate player, but I'm never going to play at the next level because I'm not fast enough and twitchy enough to play end, and I'm not that just creature from the Blue Lagoon to play inside.
Those old college power forwards.
Yes.
There's just no role for that in the NBA.
And then you're like, Danny Fortson was 6'5", and he could do it. Yeah, Danny Fortson was like Michael Bennett.
Dude, every,
pretty unique.
Every year, Boston College would have one of those guys.
Yes.
Craig Smith was the best, and Lou Rowe at UMass. Like, there were just 100 of them in the Northeast. That's what we had. We had a lot of guys that were, like, good college power forwards. So, all right, I get where you're coming from. Question two. Speaking of the college game, Brock... Are you ready to accept the fact that UW's not an elite program yet?
They're not elite. They're not great. And this year, they're not even good. This year, they're absolutely middling. I had a friend of mine, a Cougar, try to, you know, stir me up again and just be like, hey, after this game, I saw people tweeting about this too. And it's always kind of a reaction as they sit at 2-3. And it's like, I think it was, I don't even know who it was. Look, well, when are the Husky fans going to realize? Are you just a, you know, since the 90s, you've been nothing but a very average program that averages 6 or 7 wins a year and just, you know, accept that. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to accept that.
You shouldn't.
I'm gonna actually.
Why would anybody accept it?
I'm going to, A, spit that out of my mouth. B, Chris Peterson won double-digit games multiple years, won the Pac-12 title multiple times, placed a ton of dudes in the NFL. Many of them are Pro Bowl and All-Pro and some of the most special players, Vita Vea, Buda Baker, and others. And oh, by the way, if Jake Browning doesn't throw a pick before halftime with Bama, that game, they're in a national semifinal, not in 1916, not in 1976, not in 1996. That was in 2016. So it takes the right people. You absolutely have to have, and Chris Peterson is one of the 5 to 10 best coaches in the history of, or not history, in the last 20 years of college football, 30 years of college football. What he did at Boise and what he did here was truly spectacular. And no, I will not just accept that, oh, yep, you're just going to be an average program.
I think you're right, Brock. You shouldn't just accept it. I would agree with that. And watching, what game was that? Well, Joe Tryon is playing well. Like, it just feels like you see a lot of good.
He added a new last name, Tryon.
Yeah, he's added. Huh?
Shoyink.
Yeah.
Shoyink.
He's playing well, though. Where is he?
Tampa. Yes.
Yeah, he looks good.
He's with Vita Vea down in Tampa.
It seems like there's a ton of those guys out there. But I think there's also got to be an understanding that if you don't have a Chris Peterson, it's not just going to happen for you.
That's
that you've got to work harder than the average bear in order to get there. Yep. But if you do make all the right decisions and you do create the right vibe in the Northwest and keep all the local products here, you can be a not quite Alabama elite going every single year and winning championships, not Ohio State.
Yep.
But you could be in that next tier after that and competing for those things and going to the Final Four every few years. That seems like a reasonable kind of goal. But you got to A, accept that that's the goal, and then B, actually be accountable to that, which means you got to keep your local guys here.
Yep, there's no question. I got Ohio State this week, and obviously G. Scott Jr. is playing tight end there. It's kind of their pass-catching second tight end. They got Emeka Abuka, who's going to be their next star freshman receiver. He got an 86-yard touchdown the other day. JT, big defensive tackle out of Eastside Catholic, is now starting at Ohio State as a true freshman.
He's so good, huh?
Yeah, and those are guys right there. Not even, like, far. Those are guys within
20 miles.
Right.
Yes. Of your campus.
So you got to get that fixed or forget about it. All right, question number 3. A lot of conversation. I had a really good conversation with Pete the other day about DK Metcalf and just how much he likes him. Pete loves him. And talking through how to, you know, who he is as a person and how to, like, help him, you know, get to his goals without going down the road that some of the other wide receivers in the past have with his build and his skill set. That's not to say DK's like any of those guys, but helping him avoid some of those pitfalls. His route running is great. I mean, God, we talked about the touchdown he had this week. The size, the speed, the effort, all of it. Can he improve his hands? Is that possible to get better?
He has improved his hands, but I think that there is a bit of a ceiling on that because you still see, and, you know, the deep ball, and there was obviously some physical contact, so that was not just a total, at first glance, I was like, oh. But Russell underthrew it a little bit, and that's a ball that, A, Russell can throw a little better, and B, DK can snatch, right? So, and take away from that defender before he gets his hands in there. You saw another one on the sidelines that he did drop, that, you know, he has had drops, and he has worked his tail off. I think I told you this story a couple years ago. I was filming in the indoor facility for a nonprofit, and it was his, this was his rookie year. This is late in the season, and it's at night, 7, 8 o'clock. Everyone has left. That's why we could go in there and film. And sure enough, in comes DK, far end, tennis balls, jugs machine, right? He's just in there for a half hour, 45 minutes on that jugs machine, just catching tennis balls, right? One hand, two hand, you know, to the right, to the left, forward, back, all of it. And you can work your tail off on that. But I do think that there is a corollary, and I've said this to you before as well, with the accuracy of a passer. That Jake Locker could throw a million passes, and he was not going to be as naturally accurate as Damon Heward. Just Damon was, my older brother, was innately accurate, had incredible command. You can take a pitcher, Mike, and they could throw 6 million pitches, and they will not have the command of Greg Maddux. Right? It's just like, wow, I got the same mechanics. I'm going to the same pitching coach. I'm doing all the same things. Yep, but that guy just is innately accurate. And when you have a Dane Looker or someone, a Derek Mays that I played with, just innate pass catcher, they were suction cups. And it just did not matter. Contact didn't matter. The weather didn't matter. Gloves, no gloves. It didn't matter what the route was. They had just a softness, a feel. Like, I don't see him as having soft hands. And maybe it's hard because he's, 6'3" and rocked up and unbelievably twitchy.
This is Achilles' heel. Everybody has to have one. Otherwise, he'd be perfect.
Yes.
I'm okay with his hands not being perfect.
And you know what? Julio was the same way.
He's not perfect.
Julio Jones was the same way. Yeah. Julio Jones had drops. And that's probably the comp. He's going to do all he can to try to soften it and to grow it. But is he going to be Steve Largent? No.
Good stuff. There you go. When I imagine him with those tennis balls, I keep thinking of the scene in Miracle where he gives Jim Craig the tennis ball and his gun and the tennis balls at him in the hallway and he's making him save the tennis ball.
Yes.
All right, good stuff, man. Obviously, we have a Seahawks game Thursday night, so we'll have quite some time before we record next week, but we'll have a lot to get to, man. It should be a lot of fun. By then, the Kraken will be playing legitimate regular season games as well, so should be
Tuesday
a lot of
night,
fun.
Right?
Yeah, Tuesday night down in Las Vegas, and then a couple weeks from then, they'll be here on Saturday night for the opener of the new building. I can't believe they built a new building. Gosh, it feels like ages ago.
Is there
going
to be role-playing, you think, in Vegas for that opener?
I don't know, but we'll talk to you next week. Until then, the hay.
Barn.
See you, everybody.
This is the chopper!